Oh, the car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered. Like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches. But there aren't, right?
Right. Because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at carvana.com.
But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Good morning and welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shortell, and I'm here with co-host, dear friend, and producer Stu Schrager, who's also the ticket procurer of the century. Thank you for those tickets, by the way.
You know, Tom, you are the reason I had to go down and check out what this band was all about.
Uh-huh. Yeah, what was the name of them? Suicide Tendencies or something?
Suicide Boys.
Suicide Boys. That's uplifting.
So the way to sort of frame this is they are a gothic hip-hop band. Two white guys, cousins
mm-hmm.
from Georgia, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
They had this, I guess, dark music. You mm-hmm. know, again, it was what was really an incredible attendance. What was amazing is everybody bought merch. I just couldn't believe what I was seeing.
Really?
But it was really interesting night. And it was funny because they mostly performed. Then at the end, they gave some speech to the audience, very uplifting. And actually, the band is from New Orleans, so I stand corrected. But they talked about, I think the story goes, and where the name comes from, is when they were growing up, they got into a band, and they said if they didn't make it by a certain time, they were going to consider
killing themselves. That's a pretty bold statement,
right,
thinking of a music business.
They were talking about how, in their mind, they were misfits, they were lazy, they were druggies, this, that, and the other. And at one point, they found God.
Mm-hmm.
And he helped them lift them to where they were, where they are. They said they're not, in quotes, cured yet. They still have depression,
issues,
and this
yeah.
and that. But the message that they put forth, which is always so important, as long as it's a positive message, is to take it as it comes, you know, step by step, 5 minutes at a time, half hour at a time, day by day. You're not always going to be in a perfect situation, but hopefully being there, trying, reaching out to people that can help you, you can get to where you need to be.
No, that's good. It's better than, I hate preachy musicians and preachy actors and actresses. For some, I don't know what it is, but for some reason, that ilk seems to think that their opinions are so important that they have to be expressed to everybody else, you know? And the problem with political opinion is you're not really changing anybody's mind. You're just emoting, you know? And, I see it all the time. I had a friend, I'm going to bring this back to the restaurant business. I had a friend who was an anti-Bush guy, anti-Trump guy. And every day he was on the internet posting these, diatribes about Trump this and Trump that and Trump the other thing. And I don't care, it could have been any, it could have been Biden or whatever. But the bottom line is, I said to him, I said, what you're doing is you're just alienating half of your clientele base. I don't care. I don't need these people. I've been in this business a long time. You need everybody. Trust me, everybody, especially on Monday. But the bottom line is, I always told all my people, I don't care what your political views are. On the internet, you are Switzerland. Everybody's Switzerland on the internet.
So that be said, and I have to ask, we have to behave and respect others. But we do get communications from our listeners,
mm-hmm.
and we talked about the Ryder Cup, and somebody came back to us and had some opinion. It was Richard G., and in all fairness, I will read his email. This past week, while you were having said you were not being political, you were. Mentoring the grand reception that Trump received at the Ryder Cup was very political. Characterizing it as non-political is insulting to anyone with a brain. Again, we respect everybody's opinions, and we're not going to prophesize. Richard goes on to say he listens every week. He's met Tom many times. And what he feels was lacking in our discussion was that the fact that it cost a lot of money for him to be there and I guess uses the position to flaunt himself. So at any rate, I do have the chutzpah to acknowledge your email. I respect your opinion, as does Tom. And we try not to be political, just as Tom was saying before he even heard about this email. So we'll move forward in today's program and try not to be political, which is a fair ground to be on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we don't get into politics here much. I mean, the bottom line is, again, like I said, you know, nobody's changing anybody's mind. You're just emoting, and I don't know. I just, you know, as far as the Ryder Cup goes, it's, you know, I think we just acknowledge the fact that he was there. I didn't, you know, I don't think it's a good idea or bad idea. It's none of my business, really. But the bottom line is, the Ryder Cup to me is just a fun watch, man. I don't care who shows up. It's just, it's really fun to watch. And as much as, yeah, I guess I pull for the U.S. team, you know, just because, you know, I live here. But I just want to watch good golf. And those guys just play great golf, all of them. You know, I mean, that last day when the U.S. had absolutely no chance to get within, you know, a
point.
It
was exciting.
It was great. It was great theater, you know.
It was exciting. But again, just to finish what Richard was saying, I think he was just stating that you know, we all paid for the president to be there. But going to what you were saying, it was so exciting. I got to admit, when I watch basketball and a player misses a free throw, I'm kind of skeptical. How can that happen? Because that's what they do. Put the ball in the hoop. And again, you can't control everything. So if you're being guarded by somebody and somebody blocks or hits you when you're shooting the ball,
yeah,
you're not in control of that. You can just try your best. But when you're throwing a free throw, it's just you and it's just the pressure on you. So when somebody misses, wow, take that forward to golf. Both teams were really bad at putting.
Well, the U.S. team for sure. I mean, I think Tommy. I was watching Tommy Fleetwood for a while because he comes from the same area that my family comes from, up in northern England, and I'm kind of a fan of his. He's a very classy guy, you know. He's good on interviews or whatever. Anyways, he was dropping putts from everywhere. I mean, it was just, and it's, you know, it's one of those things. I was talking to my friend Dave about this when we were playing golf the other day. I said, you know, I said, what is it about golf where you know, you can be totally schizophrenic in the same round. Like I had a couple of rounds last week where I was absolutely horrendous on the front nine, and I was playing like Greg Norman on the back nine, you know. And it's like the same guy. What happened? But then you realize not every if athletics was, if everybody was good all the time, I mean, the pitchers would be 40-0, you know, all the guys would be batting 1,000 or 900 or whatever. Athletics is a funny thing. I mean, days that you have it and days that you don't. And I guess it spills out into other parts. I mean, I know there are days when, you know, my cooking thing or in the kitchen, nothing's going right. You know, everything's a hassle. Everything's a bother, you know. And in other days, it's smooth as glass. I think that's just life. You know, life is difficult at times and easy at others. And, you know, you just got to kind of, I've been doing a lot of reading about Chinese monks, you know, because I was into that kung fu thing forever. And, you know, they always talk about failures being the best teacher, you know, and it's true. I mean, you know, I'm not promoting failure, but the more you fail, the more you learn. I think they call it experience, you know. And so, you know, you got to take those moments and you just got to, you know, kind of learn from them and see how you can make it better, I guess. But in golf, it's hard because you go hole to hole, you know. It's only you get 10, 12 minutes to figure everything out. And, you know, sometimes it's impossible. But that's, you know, golf as it is.
So it is. So it is. So it's a little chilly this morning.
Yeah, first sign of fall, I think, since we've entered, you know.
So, and as things go, today is Thursday. Again, we tape earlier the show. The radio station is going out on a cruise ship for the day.
Really?
How chilly.
A cruise ship with, like, pools and gambling and just a kind of a...
I guess I'm over-elaborating. We're going out on
boat.
A boat from Freeport, but it's really chilly.
Oh, yeah, and it's colder on the water, man. I remember nights, you know, I had a boat for years, and, you know, you go fishing at night, and, you know, you'd be out there, it's like 6 o'clock, and the sun's up, and you're in a T-shirt, and all of a sudden the sun goes down, and it's really not that cold. It's like in the low 70s, and you're freezing for some reason, you know. Hey, that's a rhyme there, freezing for a reason.
That's for sure. So at any rate, a chilly day like today, the weekend's coming. I think they're expecting a nor'easter. So if one is to be all hatches down and you're going to be staying home this weekend, what's a good food project that you might suggest to our listeners?
I think pasta making is one of the most fun things that you can do. If you got a little time and you got the energy and you want to get off the couch and turn the TV off, pasta making is so much fun because there's so many ways to go. I mean, and the results are you know, unless you completely screw it up, the results are pretty easy to do and they're fabulous. You know, there's nothing like fresh pasta, in my opinion. One of the most, you know, easy to do and flavorful meals. And you can do all kinds of things. You can stuff them. You can, you know, make different shapes. I mean, it's hard to do without an extruder. I mean, you can't do penne or anything like that. But you can certainly roll. You can make, kinds of different kinds of dough, like a potato dough for gnocchi. You can do a semolina flour thing, one with egg, one without. And a lot of fun, you know. And I think it's a great project for... It's a great project to do with children. If you have them around, grandkids or kids, and they're at that age, you know, they're stuck in the house. And if you want to get them off the computer and the TV, which is probably a good idea, pasta making is so much fun. The only downside is the cleanup because flour gets everywhere. So you can, if you're not worried about the cleanup, you can have an awful lot of fun. And, pasta is fairly easy to make. The hardest part is the kneading, you know. Once you get, you can look up and get different recipes. I'm not going to give you a recipe now because you have to figure out how much you want to make and how many people you want to feed. But it's the process is always the same. You put your flour on a bench or on the counter, and you make a little well in the center, and you put your eggs and oil in there, and you slowly bring in the sides and incorporate the flour into the egg. And then at that point, once you get it all incorporated, you got this big, kind of furry mess there. And you're going to pull that together, make a ball, and then you're going to kind of knead it by folding it to you and then pushing it away with the heel of your hand and then folding it back to you and pushing it away with the heel of your hand to keep going like that. And until you get this like smooth ball, and then you want to just kind of rest it for, wrap it in plastic and rest it for about a half an hour, 40 minutes. And then you can roll it out. If you have a little pasta maker, you can put it through the pasta maker and you start that, on a number like 5 or 6. And then, you slowly get it down to 4 and then you put it through again in 3 and 2 until you get it to the thickness that you like. And once you do that, then you just have to cut it. And most of those pasta machines have dies that you can, pass it through and it'll cut, like a fettuccine noodle or cut a linguine noodle or something like that. Or you can leave it large and just, do... pappardelle, you can cut them with a knife and, in a thick, maybe an inch wide noodle. Or at that point, you can stuff them. You can make, ravioli, any kind of ravioli or tortellini, agnoletti, any of the stuffed pastas. It's really a pretty easy process. It's just a little time consuming and a little messy. But other than that, I think it's great. And the great part about pasta is it's just... Your imagination is your only, your only handcuff. I mean, you can, the different sauces that you can make, you different stuffings that you can do, especially this time of year. I like to stuff pastas. I like to, You know, I like to do pumpkin ravioli. I like to do butternut squash ravioli. I like to do parsnip ravioli, sunchoke ravioli, some things. You know, you puree root vegetables. Even, you know, in Italy, they use potatoes, they use potato ravioli. And it's not unusual because when you think about gnocchi, you have a potato pasta. So potatoes and pasta seem to, you know, go hand in hand. And they're just fun to make. They're you know, it's a great project for the kids, and it's something that they can use for the rest of their lives if they get, you know, kind of adept at it, you know, and pretty good. And there's also that thing with kids that, you know, once they conquer something, they get, you know, there's a sense of pride there and a sense of accomplishment. And I think that's important for kids, and it's kind of fun to do, and it's a sense of accomplishment that you can eat. You know, you don't have to put it on a shelf and look at it. You just eat it, and it's over, and you start again tomorrow. So I think that's, to me, that's probably one of the most, you know, sort of family together fun kind of things to do on a snowy or a cold day when, you know, everybody's tired of being outside. Well, you can't go outside. I mean, we're going to have a nor'easter, they say, I think Monday and Sunday and Monday or something like that. And of course, I'm playing golf Monday, so that kind of, you know, sort of goes along with my luck. But yeah, and like I said, if you look up on the internet, you'll find literally hundreds and hundreds of pasta recipes. you can just write them down. And find the ones that you like best. Find the ones that come out best for you, and then you know, keep them in your recipe box for you know, future use. The other thing too about pasta making is that, you know, you get to make a sauce now, and that's the other half of it. So, you know, once you have your pasta and it's all ready to go, and you know, now you got to think about what kind of sauce you're going to make with it. And again, you have there's so much more out there than tomato sauce. And I think in America, I think even, you know, as far as the home cook goes, you know, there's usually a red sauce involved because they're easy to make and they keep well. There's acid in the tomato. You don't have to worry about them going bad or whatever. You know, a lot of people rely on a meat sauce, like a bolognese, or make a marinara with, you know, what they call, I guess, a Sunday sauce with maybe sausage and meatballs and stuff. And all of that's great. You know, I love those sauces. I think they're, you know, probably standard bearers for most pasta. But there's so many other ways to go. There's, you know, there's pasta with fresh vegetables. There's, you know, white sauces that involve nothing more than, you know, take a cacio e pepe, which is just, you know, pecorino cheese and or Reggiano. And the sauce is made with just a little water that you made the pasta in, that you cooked the pasta in. There's a little starch in there, so it thickens up the cheese and the pepper. You know, there are many sauces that have a little cream in it, and most people kind of, you know, shy away from that because heavy cream is, you know, the caloric content is too much for some people. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to pasta sauces, I mean, there's just an array of, you know, I mean, here's a great one. I mean, you know, I've had pasta in Italy with just zucchini, you know, just pasta with zucchini, garlic, a little bit of the water from the pasta cooker. And it's fabulous. You put a little cheese and pepper on it and away you go.
Yeah, but that's nothing on it. Olive oil and pepper is, you know, that's tasty.
Yeah. No, I mean, if you have great olive oil and fresh garlic, you're pretty much home. You don't need anything else. And a little cheese, you're in good hands there, you know. And that's the beauty of pasta. I mean, I think, you know, sometimes in America, and I'm guilty of it too as a professional, I mean, sometimes we just tend to over-orchestrate things looking for that, you know, secret flavor or whatever, when really all you need is what you have, you know, as long as, you know, if you have... You know, if you take Tuscan cooking, if you've ever been to Tuscany, basically their cooking is pretty simple. They rely on perfect ingredients at the peak of their powers. You know, they cook seasonally, and great olive oil and great cheese. I mean, you don't really need anything else. You know, it's kind of, you know, an overabundance sometimes in America, and we throw, you know, peas in it and this and that and the other thing. You don't need all that stuff. It's just sometimes it's just, you know, that little you know, a little cheese, a little olive oil, a little garlic, salt and pepper, and you're pretty much ready to go. But I think, you know, getting back to the original premise, I think that pasta making is one of the most fun things you can do, and you can do it with children, and you can do it as an adult. You can make a little pasta party, you can have your friends over, whatever. It's just a ball to do, and I think, you know, we rely on dried pasta, you know, and it's convenient, and I get it. You know, time is really the the one commodity that we all seem to be short on. But if you have the time and you're going to kill a day, I mean, making pasta is a great way to do it. You know, I used to, there was my friend growing up, Louis DeMau, was, I always tease that Louis DeMau looked just like Mao Zedong, but he was Italian. Somehow the gene pool got a little screwy there. But his mom was one of the best cooks I ever knew. And she used to make lasagna, and she would lay, not lasagna, a ravioli, and she would lay them out on a bed sheet. She put a bed sheet on the bed, and she would make like, I don't know, 150, 200 or whatever. She would flour the bed sheet and lay them on the bed to dry, you know. It was like, it was hilarious. And I was like, wow, you know, that's kind of genius, you know. How, you know, home cooks, they figure this stuff out.
That sounds like the old wives' tale that I heard about my ancestry. You know, Jewish soul food is gefilte fish, which is essentially ground fish.
Yeah.
And, you know, when it came to holiday time, a couple of days before, there might be a fish floating around in the bathtub.
Yeah. Yeah, I serve gefilte fish like twice a year, usually at Passover and Rosh Hashanah. I don't have any idea how people get that down. I mean, it's just, it's awful to me personally. And actually, to my customers who are under 80, you know, you have to be over 80 to really enjoy gefilte fish, I think. You know, it's one of those things that it's old people food. You know, it's funny. I do bar mitzvahs and stuff like, you know, in the holidays, Jewish holidays. And Don, who's the great guy, actually, the manager at Mill River, you know, he comes from an entire, you know, most of his career was in Jewish clubs. So he's always going, oh, you got to get whitefish salad and you got to get smoked this and smoked that. And the funny thing is, nobody eats it. The only thing that most people eat at bar mitzvahs, if they go and smoke fish, is the salmon, you know. And we go through a lot of smoked salmon, which is great. I love smoked salmon. But the whitefish salad, I think it's, again, you got to be over 80 to eat it. You know, it's like, I think it's kind of nostalgia food for people. I think it's, you know, the older people who grew up on that and ate it as kids and stuff do it. But the younger people, you know, the 40 and under crowd, not so much. I don't see a lot of gefilte fish with that crowd. I don't see a lot of whitefish salad being eaten, you know, by anybody under 40 years old. And it's probably true of all cultures, but it's very apparent in with Jewish cuisine, because I do those dinners twice a year, so I see it firsthand. You know, if I have, you know, 80 people for dinner, maybe I'll sell five orders of gefilte fish, or, you know, maybe I'll use a, you know, half a pound of whitefish salad. Nobody really eats that anymore, you know. Yeah, and you can see it now because the appetizing stores all disappeared.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting thing. I mean, the scenario is that there used to be appetizing stores, which were smoked fish, essentially delis. They disappeared. They morphed into bagel stores. And at the same time, that type of stuff, I have to think it was mostly a weekend.
Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah.
But there was also a charm about those stores. There was a certain, you know, nostalgic charm. You had the older guy with the little white hat with the points on either side, you know, serving you. And his name was usually Izzy or Mel or something. And you got to know him, and you went there every weekend. And there was a camaraderie camaraderie is probably not the right word. But there was a back and forth there that was, you were a regular. You know, they'd say, hey, Tom, you know, I mean, there was that older man that I used to go to that appetizing store in Roslyn, Andell's, right? And he'd say, hey, Tom, you know, what's it this weekend? Same thing, you know, smoked salmon on a bagel, you know. You don't see that anymore with, like, the bagel bosses and stuff. It's too busy. It's, you know, and good for them. I don't mean too busy like it's a bad thing, but it's too busy for them to interact most of the time, you know. And a lot of times you have the young kids there in the restaurant business. And you know, there's just not that personal thing that there was, like, that I miss from Andels. I used to like going in there talking. What was his name? Do you remember his name, the older fellow that was behind the counter?
Abe.
He was a hoot, man. Had a sense of humor. He was a funny guy, you know. I used to sit there and stand there and talk to him for 15, 20 minutes every time I went in, you know. Good man.
Yeah, no, it was good times, to say the least. Good times, to say the least. You know, you talk about the salads, whitefish salad, baked salmon salad. I always think of those almost as the weekday version of the real thing, which is a whitefish, which I guess they call, for some reason, at least at the appetizing store, a small whitefish is a chub.
Mm.
And then there's baked salmon, and, you know, when I go in to get baked salmon, how many fingers? That means how wide do you want it?
Yeah.
You know, my mom, she loves baked salmon. That's her thing.
Uh-huh.
And I guess my sister followed in her way. It's not bad. You know, whitefish, most places will have the small whitefishes. During the holidays, they have these big things. And if you want to get a half a fish, I'm always confused. Do you want the tail section or do you want the head section?
No, it's the left or the right. You know what I mean? You don't want to cut. You got to cut them the other way.
And then there's an art of filleting that stuff. You know, there's nothing worse than having a bone in it. I know you're going to laugh because you go, well, fish, they have bones in them. You know, that's a casualty of war.
Yeah. Well, I fillet a ton of fish, so I get it, you know. And I you know, it's funny when you talk to, like, Valerie's Greek, right? And she's first generation born in America. Her parents and her brothers and sisters were all born in Greece. So she's very, very connected to the culture. And, you know, if you give Greek a fish without bones, I mean, look at you like you're out of your mind, you know? And they're taught to eat, you know, as a kid. I mean, they just pay attention, be careful. We'll try and get the bones out for you. But, you know, you got to fend for yourself at some point. In America, we kind of, you know, it's a fillet. I don't want the head. I can't look at it. The eyes are looking at me. I don't want the tail. You know, we get all of that stuff here. And I kind of prefer fish filleted myself because I don't want to do the hunting thing and I'm not looking for bones myself. But the bottom line is there is a flavor aspect to the bones in the fish. And, you know, it's subtle for sure, but it's there. And, you know, some people just, you know, can't have it any other way. And I find that, you know, you have two camps. You have the for the bones and against the bones. And, you know, sometimes, you know, it's funny, you put something on a menu like, you know, whole fish or whatever. And it says right there, whole fish. So they know they're getting a whole fish, you know. And you'll send it out and they'll send it back and you fillet it for me. You know, it's like, it's not like I have nothing to do here. You know, we're kind of busy. You know, if you want to fillet a fish, then order a fillet of fish. What are you doing with the whole thing, you know?
Well, doesn't most of the time the whole fish come filleted?
No, if you order a whole fish, I mean, it comes whole, you know? So, I mean, you can, yeah, there's some restaurants that'll do it at the table for you.
Right.
But they
right.
say that, you know what I mean? There's others, if you do like a, you know, the Chinese have that whole fried fish that comes in, they got it in an S, you know, they put a skewer in it, make it like an S shape, and they douse it with some kind of sweet and sour sauce or whatever. You're on your own. You're picking it off. I mean, you know, I can't tell you. People are funny, man. I have people, they'll order a steak, right? Just a regular New York strip. And they'll send it back. Can you cut it for me? What are you, 12? I mean, if you're an adult and you have a steak knife, you should be able to deal with that. You know, it's just, they don't realize that, you know, we're on to the next group of dupes here. We're on to the next bunch of people that are trying to eat, you know. And when you send something back, if it needs to be dealt with, if it was overcooked or undercooked or whatever, fine, you know. But to just do extra work is kind of, you know, you're throwing a wrench into the gear shift lever here and you're messing things up. So
I don't know how we're going to get to this point, but bouillabaisse, that is a fish stew?
Yeah, kind of.
Fish soup?
Yeah, so, well, it's more a soup than a stew. Yeah, bouillabaisse is a, you know, it's a specialty of Marseille, France, which is on the water. And basically what you do is you make a soup. You start with fish bones and you get this really aromatic broth, you know, a bunch of herbs and spices, whatever. And once you get the broth made, you know, you strain out all the bones and the fish residue. And you have this beautiful fish broth. And in that broth, they season it with tomato and saffron. And saffron's an interesting herb. It makes everything yellow and has a specific flavor. And it's really one of the most expensive commodities in the world. I mean, it's the pistol of a flower. So, you know, it's actually more expensive than heroin. I think it's, I don't know, a couple of $1,000 a pound. I mean, a pound of saffron would probably fill the room because they don't weigh anything, you know, the pistols of the flower. But so it's seasoned with that and, you know, and some, you know, onion and peppers. And what they do is they steam the fish a little at a time. You know, the thicker fish go in first and the shellfish a little last. And so they just open it and not overcooked. But it's a beautiful stew. And then they always or usually serve it with a crostata, a piece of bread that's covered with rui, which is like a red pepper aioli, for lack of a better term. And yeah, it's great. I mean, it's light, it's healthy, it's fabulous. You know, I love bouillabaisse. And I you know, the French, I mean, the Italians have a, the Italians in San Francisco have a cioppino, which is kind of the same, but the broth is much thicker and more tomatoey, you know. The broth for bouillabaisse is as thin as a soup. You know, it's not thickened at all. So what's the difference, really?
Gotcha.
But they're both great, you know.
So when I think about Italian food, one of the there's two things that complement the so-called main event, the food. There's the bread, which I was wondering if you could take us through the different varieties of bread or whatever. It's complicated enough that pasta comes in all sorts of different shapes and sizes. What's the one that's like a straw? It's a tube.
Bucatini?
Bucatini.
Yeah.
But not only do you have all these different shapes, there's different sizes. I went to the wholesaler the other day, the guy in Farmingdale on Millbar, and there's three different bucatellis.
Yeah, number one, number three, number seven, or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
how big, you know, it's just the size of the hole, you know? Yeah, bucatini to me is a pain in the neck to eat because it never really wraps on the fork. It's always that one piece that's hanging out there that kind of smacks you in the chin when you're trying to eat it, you know, and you get it all over your beard.
And what's your opinion of angel hair?
Angel hair is, I love eating it. It's a pain to cook because you have to cook it to order. You can't cook it ahead of time. You have to cook it to order.
You almost have to cook it definitely al dente because it's going to...
Yeah, it'll mush up.
It's going to mush up.
Yeah. That's a culinary term, mush up. But... yeah, angel hair is great. It's just it's tricky to cook because it cooks and it's quick and it clumps up really fast. If when you sauce it, it can get a little clumpy and mushy. So you got to be careful with it. I don't use it much, not for any other reason other than it's a pain in the neck. But I think there are so many other shapes that I'd rather deal with. So we don't play with it much. So speaking of Italian food, I got to tell you, I went to a place, I've been there three or four times. It's in Carr Place. And for me to go back to Carr Place is always kind of a fun thing. And I never just go to the restaurant. The restaurant's called Moro's, M-A-U-R-O-S. And it's owned by a man named Joey Moro. Joey is a resident of Carr Place probably for the last 20, 25 years. And he owns Cardinale Bakery.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so Joey's a great guy. He's a good buddy of mine. Roger Vai introduced me to him years ago, and so we became friends. And he's great. He always donates bread to these fundraisers. He's involved in community. He's just a great guy all the way around. And he had a little place called La Bottega there. I guess it was, I don't know if they franchise those or whatever. There's a bunch of them around. But anyway, he had this place, La Bottega, and decided that he wanted to do a restaurant instead. So he went in, did a complete renovation. Place is beautiful. And he's got a full bar in there now. And in my humble opinion, the menu's a little too big, but it's a huge menu. He's got all kinds of pasta and pizza and, all the Italian specialty stuff, the veal and beef and fish and paninis. You know, he's got paninis. It's kind of, got something for everybody. And I've been there a few times, and the food's really good. I mean, some of the things I've had are better than others, but everything's been pretty good. And I'm proud of him, man. He's, you know, he's a baker, and you know, to make that transition to restaurants, not easy. But if you go there, his brother Augie, who's maybe the biggest human being I've ever met in my life, he's a sweetheart of a guy, and thank God, because he's the size of Rhode Island. I mean, you know, and it's not like he's tall. He's maybe 6 foot, but he's wide and he's thick. He's just this big, bulky guy, I think weightlifter kind of guy, but a sweetheart of a guy, and into it, into, you know, choosing wines. He's got some really nice wines by the glass. He turned me on to an Italian Chardonnay that I like, and he gave... He gave Val a really interesting Pinot Grigio Rosé blend, which was actually really good. And they allow me to bring my own wines in, which is good for me because I have way too much wine. And so I brought a reserve Barbaresco from 2018. And, you know, I shared it with Augie and, you know, gave him a glass. But, you know, we had a really good grilled octopus. We had a nice pizza special. I've had bolognese there. They're like Pappardelle bolognese is absolutely textbook perfect. They do some really good work, and they got a young Spanish guy in the kitchen, and he's just turning out great food all the time. And it's not expensive. It's one of those places where you can still go and get out of there. You know, if you're not a wine hound like I am, I mean, you could probably get out of there for under $100 for two people easily. And have a really good, satisfying meal. It's right on Westbury Avenue in Carl Place, where Cardinale Bakery is, right next door. And across from, I told you, when I go to Carl Place, I just can't go to the restaurant. I have to go to, oh, that's where I hung out when I was 12. Oh, that's where Sam and Joe's Luncheonette was. Oh, my God, there's the hill. Oh, there's my old house. You know, it's just this whole roots trip that I go through every time I get to Carl Place. It's ridiculous. But if you get a chance... and you just want a really good Italian meal, you know, weekdays or whatever. It's not big, small place. They probably seat about 40 people at the most, I would think. But done real well, man. Check out Moro's. It's a sleeper. It's nothing you're going to pass on a highway. And they don't do big advertising. They have a nice little local crowd in there. And check it out. It's worth the drive. It's really a cool little place.
Sounds like a nice place to be. What other restaurants attract you to the hometown?
Carl Place. Oh, West End Cafe, obviously. West End Cafe.
That's under different ownership than the gentleman that visited with his son many years ago.
Yeah. Billy sold it to his employees.
Oh.
So Lou is still the chef there. He's been a chef there forever with Billy. And his partner is the manager. I don't know her. I can't remember her name. I didn't really know her all that well. But, yeah, those two places, the diner that used to be Libby's, I think it's called Olympic or something. I'm trying to think of Majestic, the Majestic Diner across from where Fortunoff's is. I go there a lot. There's that taco place too, Tucumbi. Have you been to Tucumbi?
No.
It's really kind of like, it's almost like going to Mexico, man. It's really kind of authentic. I love it. I think they do a great job there. It's almost like eating in somebody's garage. It's kind of a almost like a Quonset hut kind of building. They got these like little metal chairs and little metal tables with you know, logos on them. All Mexican cola, you know, kind of. It's really kind of cool, and their tacos are stellar, you know, fabulous. So I go there. I used to go to Plori before I got kicked out. Now I'm banned from Plori because apparently Val said something to the manager he didn't like. And that's it. That's the, you know, I'm trying to think if there's anything else over in that direction. I'm probably missing something. But those are the, you know, I like going there. I mean, because there's something about, they say you can never go home, you know. There's something about going home to me. That I don't get the Carl Place much. But I obviously have a soft spot in my heart for the town because of my history there. And, you know, and the Old Country Diner once in a while. That's down on the corner of Glen Cove and Old Country Road. That's cool. And I go to Garden City, which is close enough. And, you know, there's some great restaurants in Garden City. Swallow and Plancha is really cool over there. Nonabella is great. Although, as much as I love Nonabella, I think he's a great chef, but he needs to take his al dente one step further. It's al crunche, most of it, you know. It's really al dente to the point of a snap to it. But the food otherwise is great. And I get my hair cut next door. at a place called, what's it called? Oh, God, Madison Taylor. There's my my haircutter, Jerry. She's she and I have been partners for, God, I guess about, 25 years now. She's been cutting my hair. So, it brings me to that area. And so when I'm in Garden City, I'm close enough. I always take a little lap around Carr Place. And you do the same at Oceanside? You still feel the same way about that
place? I do. Yeah. I do. Like, but it's funny. It's salty sweet. I love Nathan's. I grew up on Nathan's. There was a Nathan's that was similar to what was on Coney Island on Long Beach Road in Oceanside. It was a full block.
Thursday nights.
Yeah, Thursday nights was motorcycle night. But originally it was an amusement park and a roadside stand for hot dogs and hamburgers.
Yeah, sure.
And then over the years they kept downsizing and franchising. So a couple blocks away from there, still on Long Beach Road, is a Nathan's. And the decor is incredible. It has all the nostalgia. It just doesn't seem to have a lot of clientele, but I don't know if corporate looks the other way because that's where the roots were.
Mm.
I just can't get over the fact that whenever in Oceanside, and if I'm taking out, if French fries go along with the meal, I stop there to get my French fries. But in recent times, they just put too much salt on.
Oh, really?
I mean, they just overdo it.
Huh.
And I'm sitting there almost like, wiping off the excess salt and then having to make sure that I dip it in ketchup to dilute the saltiness of it.
Yeah, you feel your ankles swelling as you eat them.
And I'm a pretty laid-back guy. I actually had a call up one night, and I called back. I said, you're just putting too much salt on it.
Oh, yeah, really?
They don't seem to care.
No. They know better. You know, Nathan's is funny. Now they're hooked up with, every Nathan's that I've seen lately has a Subway and there's like two or three different fast food.
Mini, yeah,
yeah,
that's
like a,
true.
Like a little mall thing,
We're going to hopefully one day have Frankie Chicken.
Frankie Chicken.
Come in. He owns the Nathan's in Belmore,
uh-huh,
which is a Arthur Treacher's, Chicken Holiday, and Nathan's. The guy has such a passion for what he does, and we'll let him share his stories. Great guy, great family. I was over there one night. It was funny because he stays in touch with the radio station, and I said, I have to stop by and meet him. But I had dinner across the street at Kashi, which is a Asian fusion restaurant.
Yeah, sure.
I was pretty full, and I went over there, and Frankie was there, his wife. And he says, you got to sit down. You got to have some ribs, and you got to have a piece of chicken. And I did it, but I left there so full. But he's just such a great guy, so personable, and shared the history. And what passion this guy's got.
Does Mrs. Chicken work there also?
His wife does work there, I'm going to put out an invite to Frankie. I understand he's a listener of the radio show, and hopefully we can get him in.
Yeah, maybe I can uncover some secrets there, about the breading and the length of time and the oil and all that.
It's just, he's just, he goes above and beyond, I guess, what the franchise requirements are for the different formats that are in his store. And the decor, again, he... there's no expense
spared.
It's just a great presentation and a guy with a lot of passion. And he's not even, that's not even his main thing. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, he runs a plumbing company, a local plumbing company.
I could do 20 minutes of stand-up on what you just said, chicken and plumbing. But, what's interesting to me, and I've been saying this for years, is that the restaurant business is different than I think almost any other business out there because, take the plumbing business, right? You can be in the plumbing business without having a passion for cleaning pipes. I mean, it's just that's nothing that anybody really has a passion about. It's a technical skill, and there are people that are good and better at it, but I don't see anybody going, geez, I can't wait to connect that next pipe, where the food business is something that everybody does three times a day for the most part. And I think the people that do the best job are the people who have a passion for the product. There are two reasons to be in the restaurant business. One is that you have a passion for it and can't do anything else. I would put myself in that, you know, category. I'd be miserable if I did anything else. And the second part is that people are going to it to make money. And I feel sorry for those people because there's not a lot of money in it. And some people do really well. I'm not saying, you know, you look at Danny Meyer in the city. I mean, you know, when he was doing Union Square Cafe and all these great restaurants, I'm sure he was doing okay. But then when he finally did Shake Shack, you know, he had an opening thing on the stock market at about $400 million or something. That's real money. But when profit is your primary focus, and it has to be a focus. I'm dancing on a very thin line here. When it's your primary focus and passion isn't, your product suffers a little bit, I think, because you're always worried about the cost of things, which is understandable. The people who don't care about the cost of things usually open up the better restaurants and usually go broke first. So it's one of those things where, you know, I think that's why the restaurant business has such a high mortality rate, is because you do get passionate people in there, and they don't pay attention too much to the costs until it's too late, you know?
Well, you talk about personalities in the food business here on Long Island. It comes to mind of our sponsor, Smokin' Al.
Love Smokin' Al.
That guy's got so much passion.
You know, he introduced himself to me that way. I was at Jedediah Hawkins, and he came and he goes, "Hi, I'm Smokin' Al." I'm thinking, "Hi, I'm Drinking Tom." I mean, I don't know. I was going to put my Fishy Tom, I guess, or something. You know, it's pretty funny. But he's a sweetheart of a guy. And he's a guy who, you know, again, I mean, Al's a perfect example. Al comes from a completely other business, you know, that I don't know if he had a passion or not for it. But he was in clothing, right?
Clothing. I believe that's where he comes out of.
Yeah. It's hard to get passionate about a shirt. You know, it's important. You know, yeah, okay, I like the shirt. I design it, you know, whatever, sell it. But, you know, passion, I don't know.
But he's taken it to another step because his knowledge and design skills in clothing, the uniforms that they wear at the restaurant, his passion poured through. That he's got this unbelievable logo, and again, the uniforms that the staff wears is very, very cool.
I don't know if that's passion or just good taste.
But at any rate, it's October, and I believe over at Smokin' Al's, they're celebrating Riptober. If you go to the website, you can see what the weekday special is, which is pretty economical when in today's world, prices for food are crazy. But another celebrity that has come up on my radar is Michael Della Famina. Are you familiar with him?
Oh, I knew Jerry Della Famina. I don't know if he's, you know, Jerry Della Famina was an ad guy that opened up a restaurant in East Hampton years ago. But I don't know if it's the same guy.
Well, Michael Della Famina had a restaurant in L.A. that's been very, very popular, and now it is opening in downtown, like 6th Avenue in the city. And so
that's different Della Famina. I don't know him. What was the name of his restaurant in L.A.?
Beverly Hills Hotspot, popular with stars like Leonardo DiCaprio, Harrison Ford, and Kendall Jenner, is coming to Soho. This was an article I read in a local newspaper. I guess Lola Taverna.
Don't know it.
Yeah, oh, yeah. And as it turns out, Jerry Della Famina was his father.
Oh, okay. Jerry Della Famina had a very good restaurant in East Hampton called Della Famina's. And it was great. It was, you know, I used to eat there all the time when I lived in East Hampton. And then, I don't know, he sold it to, I guess it's called East Hampton Grill now or something. Sold it to, I think they're a company, they may be the same company that owns, what's that barbecue place that was over in Roosevelt Field for a while, where the Cuban is now?
I'm not sure.
They were famous for their ribs. I can't remember. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But Jerry Della Famina, I haven't heard anything about it. I don't know if he's even still alive, Jerry. But he was, you know, he had a home in East Hampton. He was a big advertising executive guy, and he opened up this great restaurant. My friend Kevin Penner was the chef there. Kevin's a very talented guy. So he was a chef there for, I guess, I don't know, 8 or 10 years, whatever it was. Trauma, who was also a buddy of mine years ago, came out of the city and worked there in the beginning. And then Pat went on to open up his own place in Jersey called Traumas, I think. And it's T-R-A-M-A is his last name. And he's doing very well from what I hear. I haven't spoken to him in a long time. But and Kevin took over when Pat left. I think Kevin was Pat's sous chef, and he took over and did a great job also. So, yeah, it's it makes sense. I mean, the Della Famina bloodline is there. And you know, Jerry's one of those guys. It's almost like Nick and Tony's. When Nick and Tony's opened up, Tony Ross, her father was Steve Ross. He was the president of Sony Music at the time. Oh. So when Nick and Tony's opened up, you know, he invited 200 of his closest friends who just happened to be Jack Nicholson and Al Pacino and, you know, all the musicians and stuff. So what, it's really kind of funny because once a place gets that rep, it kind of sticks. And it's stuck to Nick and Tony's all these years. And to their credit, they didn't just rest on the, you know, daddy's laurels. I mean, they put together a really good restaurant with really good food, which is to their credit. And, you know, Joe, the executive chef there, does a great job. You know, he's kept Nick and Tony's relevant and special for the last 25, 30 years, you know, so 40 years maybe even now. I think they opened in 88 or 87. So, yeah, 9, 10, 11, 12, yeah, going on 40 years, you know. So it's a testament to his Realmuto is his last name, Joe Realmuto, Realmuto. He's a really good guy and a really talented chef. And Nick and Tony's, for all their reputation, because, you know, these places get these reps and, you know, because the stars go there or whatever. And a lot of times, you know, the restaurants, you know, they're not that good. Nick and Tony's is completely opposite of that. I mean, he's got a farm in the back of the place. He does, grows a lot of his own vegetables. He's the real deal. And Nick and Tony's is a great spot. If you're ever out there, you know, make sure you stop and have dinner there because it's worth every penny.
So how much time do we have left?
Let me think. We have about 6 minutes or so.
Okay. Can you spend 6 minutes talking about chicory?
No, I can't.
Can you at least give us some insight to what chicory is all about?
Yeah, chicory is a lettuce that usually it's kind of firm and curly, you know. It has a very white center and a very green outside. And eating chicory is a lot like grazing on your lawn. You know, it's I like it because I kind of like the crunch of it. And I think it does a lot for textural nuances in a salad. But for the most part, people don't buy it a lot. It's an acquired crunch. It's kind of like kale. When you get kale, the baby kale is kind of soft. If you get real kale and put it in a salad, there's a crunch to it. I mean, it's hard to eat, you know. But again, it's a great, you know. I want to say something. You know, when I was growing up, my family always used to eat. There was a salad every night, right? My mother made a salad every night that we had dinner. And she always served it after the meal. And I always thought that's the way it was supposed to be until I got into the restaurant business and I had the salad before. But my mother, you know, being from Europe, you know, having the European roots there, I guess the salad was always meant as kind of like a cleansing agent, you know, roughage and greens to, you know, kind of help the miracle. And, you know, when you eat chicory, I mean, it's got that roughage to it, you know. It's a very curly kind of lettuce, and you can actually braise it. I mean, I kind of like it cooked more than raw. If you can braise that down with some chicken stock and some onions, it's almost like escarole. Escarole is the same thing. Escarole has a very, very sort of firm chew to it, you know. The only difference is the leaves are smooth and shiny. They're not curly like the chicory. But and chicory also has a little bit of a peppery, bitter kind of flavor to it, which I find appealing. Some people don't like it, you know. It's kind of like, endive that way, you know. It has that bitter edge to it. But I think those things add a lot to a salad. I mean, I think putting it in a salad is a great idea. How am I doing so far? What am I, about 2 minutes in chicory here? Can you give me something for four? Because there's not a lot to say about chicory. I've said it all pretty much.
So let's talk wine. Give us one wine to showcase this week.
I had a Riesling the other day. It's by Domaine Weinbeck, Weinbach, W-E-I-N-B-A-C-H, called Cuvée Theo, T-H-E-O. That was just spectacular. And it rides that balance between very dry and a tiny bit off dry. There's a little bit of sweetness in there, but not much where you go, oh, God, this is a sweet Riesling. It's not. It's a dry Riesling, but it's just the balance is fabulous. It's got this laser beam acidity through it that that cuts any kind of a cloyingness sometimes they can have. The balance is just fabulous. It's not cheap, but it's not crazy expensive. I'm guessing it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $60 if you buy it in a store. But it's just, it's fabulous. And I couldn't be any more excited about, you know, a Riesling. It's from Alsace and just fabulous. And I'll give you one red that's kind of an oddball. It's called Frappato. And Frappato grape is from Sicily. And it's one of those grapes that it kind of went underground for a lot of years. And a couple of entrepreneurial winemakers decided to bring it back and vinify it. And it's Santa Teresa is the name of the vineyard. Santa as in Claus and Teresa as in T-R-E-S-A. Frappato. And they make two wines that I'm familiar with. They make a 100% Frappato, which is great. It's fairly inexpensive and it's very bright and kind of like almost like Beaujolais-like. And then they make a Nero d'Avola and Frappato blend, which is a little more brooding, a little more serious, a little more expensive, not much, but it's just one of the better wines I've had in a long time. Great food wine and just a great wine to kind of kick back. It's not a really heavy red. It's a little on the lighter side. But it has a lot of power, and it's one of the real surprises I've had. You know, I drink a lot of wine, and, you know, I taste a lot of wines through the year, and probably 400 or 500, I would think. And this one was a standout. It's in my top 10. Just a fabulous bottle, and fairly inexpensive. I think my guess would be probably in the $40, $50 range, and if you went to the store, maybe a little less, maybe 30, 35, somewhere in that zone. Just great, two great wines for you to try that are out of the box a little bit, out of the mainstream, and they're fines. You may find that at something like Total Wine, they're probably not in a local store, only because there's not a lot of call for them. But Total Wine has so much, you know, inventory and good stuff. They may have something like that, and if you don't, you could probably order it.
Very cool.
Yeah. So I guess we're getting close. Yeah, we're going to get out of here. So I'm going to close the show after that wine speech with Three Keys to Life, which is Tom's Three Keys to Life, which is Tom's Three Keys. I'm stuttering here. Life is too short
to
drink bad wine.
Boy, that's some way to fill the time.
Treat every meal like it was your last, and keep chicory in your life as important as sex and pizza.
Come on now, everybody, get ready for a treat. It's time for stepping out for something mighty good to eat. You looking for atmosphere? Well, they got it happening here. They're doing barbecue the way it ought to be. Bring your sister, brother, significant other. Bring all your pals. There's always something smoking at Smoking Al's.
Ribtober keeps on smoking. Mention Playing with Fire and enjoy Al's famous baby back rib dinner any Monday through Friday until 7 p.m. for just $14.99. That's right, a baby back dinner for just $14.99. Dinner includes a choice of a half rack baby backs or Al's famous barbecue pulled pork or chicken, a side, and cornbread, all for just $14.99. 22 years and still Long Island's favorite barbecue. Smoking Al's, Massapequa Park. For details, call 516-799-4900. And remember, there's always something smoking at Smoking Al's.
There's always something smoking at Smoking Al's.
Proud sponsor of Playing with Fire. Sundays at 9 a.m. on the new 104.7 WHLI.